They were young. They were disillusioned with and in danger from the existing punk scene. They were frustrated and angry with a world that objectified and abused them. They were the weirdos and the queers, the outsiders and the girls next door. In the college town of Olympia, Washington, a core group of women's punk bands emerged in the early 1990s, grabbing guitars and pushing their way to the male-dominated stage. The music was loud, brash, and powerful, like the girls themselves. But it wasn't just the music. It was groups of girls that sprung up around the country.
First meet self-described Riot Girl, 17-year-old Sarah McCool.
Riot Girl is a group of girls that's sort of growing every day, and basically just a group of girls who reject the sort of boy-imposed ideals of what a girl should be. And it's basically just being a girl and being extremely proud of it. And it's always open and it's continually growing, and it wants more people from like all different, you know, walks of life. It is primarily teenage girls, but it's open to anyone.
Riot Girl was a living, breathing network of zines and consciousness-raising groups and punk shows. And it scared the shit out of parents and politicians.
You know, we got a fucking right to be hostile, and I'm not gonna sit around and be peace and love with somebody fucking boot on my neck.
How did making music serve as resistance to the status quo? How did attending shows, making zines, and even just talking help girls across the U.S. fight hopelessness in the 1990s? And what can we learn from Riot Girl about how to make art as resistance today and tomorrow? From Rebel Yell Creative, this is The Art of Resistance, a podcast about channeling our rage into creation and using writing, music, and all kinds of art to resist the status quo. I'm your host and producer, Amy Lee Lillard, and I'm an author, a podcaster, and a queer Gen X punk who's been obsessing over artists who resisted since I was a kid. And today, I'm looking to make all the weird art and help others do the same. Punk music is often narrowly defined as a movement of music that flourished in the late 1970s. But more broadly, punk music is about rebellion, and it lived long after the 1970s. The punk sound is aggressive and loud, made by some talents, but also many amateurs. The lyrics rebel against anything and everything, and they're paired with performances that are visceral, destructive. What's usually assumed, though, in any description of punk music is the musicians and fans being aggressively male. This, despite the fact that David Bowie, Lou Reed, and Iggy Pop, all cited as godfathers of punk, were highly fluid in their sexuality and gender representation. And the existence of female-dominated punk bands like The Runaways, Blondie, The Slits, The Raincoats, X-Ray Specs, and many more, performing before or alongside the Sex Pistols and the Ramones. Punk lived on past its genesis in the 70s, and this aggressively male stereotype took firmer hold as punk morphed in the 1980s. In some places, punk devolved into mosh pits and bloody fists like the hardcore scene in LA. Elsewhere, punk evolved into strident political acts like the DC scene. Of course, no matter what, girls and women liked this music. They wanted to see this music. They had a lot to be angry about, and so many more rules and traditions to rebel against. But many found themselves literally pushed aside in pits and at concerts, and maybe bloodied in the bargain. In many ways, the kind of bruises they earned was indicative of the general climate for girls and women in the 1980s. So in the 1960s and 70s, the second wave of feminism won a lot of significant gains for women. The wins were big, like Roe versus Wade, and the wins were somewhat small, but actually huge in their impact, like being able to get a credit card on her own. But quickly, the second wave of feminism led to backlash. Whether right or wrong, young women in the 80s and early 90s often felt constricted by the idea of what a feminist should be. The definition of empowered women that had made its way through these decades had somehow been transformed into this capitalist superhero. It was an 80s ideal, the superwoman who has it all. So these kind of thoughts about what a feminist was were just as limited as all the old-fashioned gender roles that were back with a resurgence in the 1980s. By the early 1990s, second wave feminism at the very least needed an update. Enter the punks. In 1990 came the band Bikini Kill. Kathleen Hanna was the lead singer, and she'd volunteered with a rape shelter before forming the band. She'd also worked at a strip club, and she was deep into the spoken word poetry and underground art scene. These experiences created a very practical, complicated, and urgent feminism that informed her writing. She partnered with Toby Vail, who was a student of intersectional feminism and gender theorists, and together they formed the band. And the music they created was fierce and unhinged, raw but precise. Their songs were complaints and commands and chants at top volume.
We're beginning to kill. We want revolution!
Besides the music, the band made their representations part of their performance. Kathleen would write slut across her bare midriff, strip down to her underwear, wear pigtails and girly skirts, all the while scream singing about rape and sex and power. She demanded that male fans move to the back and girls come to the front, creating a safe space free of moshing and bodily damage for girls to rock.
All girls to the front. Not kidding.
Ultimately, the band's goals were more than music. As Toby Vail said in a 1999 oral history interview,
Bikini Kill and Bratmobile and our friends sort of had this idea that was like called the Revolution Girl Style Now. And that was sort of like our idea of like, let's just, you know, let's get all these girls to learn how to play instruments and take over and like, you know, change everything.
So right from the start, they also produced zines for each show, handmade, cut and pasted publications that they handed out to anyone and everyone, including their song lyrics and manifestos on sexism and sexual assault.
This whole kind of community was emerging, talking about sexism mostly, and just being creative artistically as women.
And this was the beginning of Riot Girl. That term itself came from the title of a zine and came to embody a movement with unlimited permutations and no clear definitions, just like girls themselves. Girls and young women wrote zines, attended shows, came together in consciousness-raising groups, and got political and active. They were practical and personal, yet deeply informed by all the political battles raging in the country. They organized festivals and conventions. Riot Girl activities were extremely varied, but they were consistent in one central theme. As Sarah Marcus says in her book, Girls to the Front, true story of the Riot Girl Revolution. The girls were furious about things like parental consent abortion laws, bikini-clad women who hawked beer and cigarettes on billboards and TV, and the archaic gender roles that pervaded the cartoon section of the Washington Post. They were ready to revolt over things like hallway gropes and sidewalk heckles, leering teachers, homophobic threats, rape, incest, domestic violence, sexual double standards, ubiquitous warnings against walking certain places or dressing certain ways. They were mustering for battle against the idea that to be a girl was to be in grave danger that you could never fully escape, only manage by narrowing your life, your range, your wardrobe, and your gaze. And for these girls, their soundtrack was women's punk. Because soon it wasn't just Bikini Kill, they were joined by other bands, inspired to take up instruments and write scenes and break all of these infuriating rules. There was Bratmobile, the self-described dorky girls that played messy and lo-fi, with lyrics that sounded like schoolyard chants and taunting. There was Heavens to Betsy, a band whose sound was pained and poetic, with collapsing or escalating song structures. And later there was Slater Kinney. When Heavens to Betsy disbanded, Corin Tucker formed a new band with Kerry Brownstein. Their sound was chaos and control, with two guitars instead of a guitar and bass. And there were other bands, of course, in the US and outside. Together, these bands sang about all the inequities and frustrations of being a woman in modern society. They sang about female bodies and their needs. They put highly transgressive subject matter front and center in their songs and their performances and called for a revolution. As the 1992 zine, What is Riot Girl Anyway, said, Riot Girl is a hand to hold and a fist in his face. Riot Girl is whatever I want it to be. It's whatever you want it to be. By 1995, it was a big enough phenomenon for even Oprah to take notice.
You're rebelling against that whole system of
just what a girl is expected to be. Uh-huh. That there are so many constraints, I feel, that young girls and women have.
And the image of the girl, rather than a woman, was deliberate. Riot Girl celebrated the loud and uncontrolled force that is girls before society steps in to box us up. Here's Kathleen Hanna from a PBS NewsHour interview.
Any woman or girl at our show, I would get their address. I would write them a postcard. I'd say, here, we're going to be here, you know, this day. Put a heart or a star on your hand. If you see another girl with that, you'll know she's interested in feminism and you guys could start a conversation.
This moment of punk, zines, and activism expanded quickly. But it buckled under crushing media pressure that depicted the bands as a silly fad, competing with one another, and Riot Girl groups as sophomoric, focusing on fashion and catfights.
Some big magazine would write something about how we were just a bunch of sexual abuse survivors who hated men, and we were ruining the punk scene, and our shows weren't really musical, they were speak outs. I mean, I could tell you a million stories, but to have to endure that, and then go on stage and be like, hey!
There was no way to know how many Riot Girls existed across the country. But it seemed like wherever girls were angry, and where were girls not angry, a Riot Girl group was there to listen and to act. The main punk bands morphed and disbanded by the late 90s, or they took new forms. Corporate capitalism seized on the main messaging. They turned girl power, which had been a rallying cry for Riot Girl, into poppy, light confection from the Spice Girls and elsewhere. The zines transformed into online forums for conversation and empowerment. But all of this had laid the groundwork for a new kind of feminism and for a new artistic aesthetic. How do you measure the impact of art? Do you measure the number of groups? The laws changed? The minds changed? The numbers aren't there for Riot Girl. They never were because they were never designed to be. There was never any tally of how many groups existed across the US or in the UK or wider. There was never any checklist to achieve. There was never any major goal of lobbying or advocacy. Because when it came down to it, it was all just girls, young girls, many of them still living at home, still living in dangerous situations. And the impact for these girls could be considered life-saving. Girls who had never told secrets before, who had never admitted to anyone what happened when the lights went out at night, or what happened in the halls of their school or in the bathroom stalls. Girls who had never heard anyone else talk about feminism or the right of women to be fucking angry. For those girls, the impact of Riot Girl meant survival. It meant maybe there was a future for them. And isn't that really the goal of art? To make us all feel like we've been seen. To make us feel like our voice matters. To make us feel like we should, that we can survive, even in the midst of horrific things. Do you measure the impact of art in the long term, in the staying power, long after the particular moment? In that case, we can look at the impact of Riot Girl and the dozens, maybe hundreds of bands that formed in their wake. The bands themselves have reunited, they're back.
I feel the same exact amount of anger. I mean, it's not like sexism stopped existing.
That's one of the beautiful things about art is resistance. It's of a moment, yes, and sometimes you can measure it in all the measures that a capitalist society wants you to use. But it also lives on. It inspires resistance now, 30 years later. It reminds us aging Gen X punks of where we are and where we need to be. And hopefully, it shows young, yet-to-be-named generations that there's a voice out there like theirs. And it's just fucking good music. What can we learn from Riot Girl? What can we do as creative people in this fucked up world? Because we are all creative. We can all find ways to resist. And here's the thing. Riot Girl didn't involve experts. There were no political advocacy consultants. There was no one guiding these young girls into how to resist. And there were no artistic virtuosos here. At least not at first. None of the girls in Bikini Kill, for example, had ever picked up instruments before starting their band. They'd never wrote songs, never played in front of others. They'd never published things. They had no idea what they were doing. But they did it anyway. They taught themselves. And the girls who came to shows, they picked up instruments too. And they wrote zines for the first time. There was no barrier for entry. There were gatekeepers, but the Riot Girls ignored them. For me, the lesson from Riot Girl is this. Make the art. Write the thing. Learn as you go. Because we all have a voice and things to say. And someone needs to hear it. Someone is confused, hurting, scared because of the fuckery of today. And the power of a song, a book, a zine, a video, life-changing. So here's what we do from here. We tell our stories. Tell your stories. The ones you've been putting off. The ones you think are too weird or loud or scary. We tell them in our way. Think zines and blogs. Think audio and visual. Think social and analog. Get creative and get weird, and work to reach the person and the people who need to see it and hear it. And don't think of this as short term. Even if we get a new administration down the road, even if we miraculously come out of this terrifying, tyrannical moment, there is so much to fight against and for. This is a long-term commitment to making art for a better world. If our work, if our art, if our voice reaches one person, even just one who really needs to read it, who sees themselves for the first time, who realizes they're not alone, who then goes on to make their own art and keep pushing against the powers that be, that's resistance. That's what we can do. The Art of Resistance is a podcast for the artists, the lovers of art, and people who want to resist but don't know how. These stories are designed to help us find inspiration from the past and empower us all to find some hope for today and tomorrow. I'm Amy Lee Lillard, and I wrote, narrated, and produced this show. And there's so much more to this story. At rebelyellcreative.com, you'll find sources, images, and videos for this episode and all the others. Plus, at rebelyellcreative.com, there's a full resistance library with posters and art to download, places to explore online, and journals and kits to get in the mail. Here's an easy way to get more art as resistance. Sign up for the free newsletter at rebelyellcreative.com and get stories and tips every week. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.